From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. You may have heard President Reagan is dead. CNN had sad music for the occasion. So did the Fox News Channel, as did MSNBC. Even the death of another American icon was viewed through Gipper-colored glasses.
Ronald Reagan was also, we've learned, a big fan of Ray Charles. In fact, in January 1985, Ray Charles was the featured entertainer at President Reagan's second inauguration.
Maybe, as some members of Congress have proposed, Reagan does belong on Mount Rushmore or the $10 bill. He was a towering 20th century figure. But the mournful tributes were rife with inaccuracies. Reagan's unequaled popularity was chanted like a mantra, despite a heap of polls that prove otherwise. It was deemed a breach of taste to recall the scandals of his presidency in the midst of mourning. Okay, maybe it was too early for a trip down bad memory lane. But how about the news that got away? There is other news, like the reality of Iraq, said Dan Rather in a Knight Ridder story on Tuesday. It got very short shrift this weekend. And we might add, not much more in the week that followed.
For instance, the most important chapter in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal opened this week with reports about a Bush administration policy memo sanctioning an unspecified degree of torture in the war on terror, contrary to the Geneva Convention. But Attorney General John Ashcroft told Congress he would not release the memo. Television was so full of tributes, you might have missed Delaware Senator Joseph Biden saying this.
There's a reason why we signed these treaties. To protect my son in the military. That's why we have these treaties. So when Americans are captured, they are not tortured. That's the reason.
During presidential death coverage on CNN's Crossfire, Paul Begala did manage to squeeze in some historic news, but then was moved to change the subject.
Right now, the United Nations is voting on the American-British resolution on the transfer of authority to Iraq. The president earlier today said he predicted a unanimous support. That would be nothing but good news for the United States. But Ken, let me ask you, you served Ronald Reagan there at the United Nations. Mm-hmm. There's been a bit of a conservative critique of the UN lately. Tell me, would he have shared that, President Reagan?
No, he was always interested in dialogue with the country.
And did you hear about the G8 summit? Leaders of the world's richest nations got together on an island off of Georgia, and nobody but the protesters seemed to care. And then there was the largely unreported first contact between Earthlings and extraterrestrial life.
This is Elmer Davis again. We still don't know what it is or where it comes from, but there's something there. This is not another flying saucer scare.
Okay, that didn't happen. But President Reagan did say several times during his term in office that the one event sure to unite America and the evil empire would be an alien invasion.
The Reagan presidency was famous for its declaration of mourning in America, no matter what time of day it was. And the man in charge of reminding the public that the sun was always on the horizon was former aide Michael Deaver. I spoke to him in January of 2001 about how he managed the media in the days of Reagan. Michael Deaver, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
You were regarded as a master of handling the press. You limited, or at least tried to limit, President Reagan's exposure to a series of photo opportunities for the evening news. You didn't seem to care much what or how much was written about the president in the newspapers, or at least that's your reputation.
It's fair to say that I always believed that most people got all their information from television. And so television was the most important part of my job. Yes, the dailies, particularly the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, so forth, were critical because whatever was above the fold was usually the top of the evening news story. So that was important. But I really felt myself more like a producer for television than anything else.
You could actually set the network's agenda for covering the president by engineering press events, couldn't you?
You could. One of the things that we did that made that easier was that we worked on a 60-90-day strategy so that I knew pretty well for the next 3 or 4 weeks what the news story was going to be 80% of the time. the people at CBS and NBC and NPR didn't know that.
And you knew which days you wanted to deflect attention from the true story of the day and which day you wanted to invite attention.
Of course.
What was your best trick for manipulating the likes of us?
Well, I never thought of myself as manipulating. I just thought of myself...
Oh, you did so.
No, no, honestly, I didn't. I just thought, look it. I remember being back here about 3 weeks and walking out and picking up the Washington Post one day on the lawn at 6 o'clock in the morning and opening it and looking above the fold and saying, this is my day. This is what I got to do today. And then I scratched my head and I said, wait a minute. The Washington Post didn't get elected anything. Why is this entire town running around what's above the fold in the Washington Post today? Shouldn't the White House, shouldn't the Congress be setting the agenda instead of the Washington Post?
Now, the Clinton administration came to town with a sort of similar notion of how to set the agenda for the press, and they just ran into all sorts of resistance and eventually had to completely back off. What did the Clinton administration do wrong?
Well, the Clinton administration didn't have the benefit of Jim Baker and Dave Gergen and some of the people early on who'd been here before in previous administrations and knew how the press corps worked. They made mistakes in sort of tactics with the press that were totally unnecessary. They didn't understand that you couldn't say something once. You had to repeat it over and over again. So they used to say, you know, poor old Bill Clinton, he had a great day, but he never had a good week because he couldn't ever stretch the story out to make it continue to pound and pound and pound.
Michael Deaver, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Public relations executive Michael Deaver was a media advisor to President Ronald Reagan.
The need for control was paramount during the Reagan years. Its policy in Central America to obstruct or prevent socialist governments was risky, to say the least. Without careful media management, what we now call the Iran-Contra scandal could have brought down the administration. Eager to support the efforts of the Nicaraguan Contra rebels to bring down the Sandinista government, in the mid-80s, the White House illegally traded arms to Iran and secretly funneled the proceeds to the Contras. Meanwhile, in El Salvador, in December of 1981, American-trained counterinsurgency fighters systematically exterminated hundreds of civilians in the village of El Mozote. The following month, the New York Times' Ray Bonner reported that, in fact, between 733 and 926 men, women, and children had been slaughtered. The Reagan administration conducted an independent investigation and declared that no massacre had taken place. Bonner was tarred as a left-wing sympathizer, his stories dismissed, and he was reassigned to a lesser beat at the Times. Eventually, he left the paper altogether. Reporter Bob Parry worked for the Associated Press and Newsweek at the time, and he says the Reagan administration had a hand in Bonner's fate.
These were the years after Watergate, after the fall of Saigon, after the scandals at the CIA. So they were very much attentive to any reporting that they felt might cause similar problems in the future. And Ray Bonner became the first example of what happens to a reporter who was crossing the Reagan administration on issues like this.
And there were others?
Sure, there were lots of others. One thing that the Reagan administration did was it created a new office at the State Department, given the name Office of Public Diplomacy for Latin America. It was run by Otto Reich. And it systematically went around Washington trying to discredit reporters who were seen as writing in ways that were causing problems for these policies. There was one case with National Public Radio where NPR had done a broadcast relating to a massacre that the Nicaraguan Contra rebels, who were, of course, backed by the Reagan administration, had committed in Nicaragua. And NPR had actually just covered the funeral of many of these farm workers who had been killed. And that provoked Otto Reich to go to the offices of NPR to try to put pressure on the editors and reporters involved in that case. So there were repeated trips to people's bureaus chiefs and people's editors. The effort was to get reporters reassigned, and they had great success.
You're cited as being one of the first journalists to report on the drug angle of the Iran-Contra scandal. Were you yourself discredited after you published critical stories?
Well, we certainly came under a great deal of pressure. I was at the Associated Press at the time, and we were not particularly liked by the Reagan administration for writing about some of that dark underbelly of the Contra operation. I must say that we were able to battle through most of the stories. Some were delayed, Some were watered down somewhat, but it didn't exactly help our relations with our editors. So you pay a price. You pay a price even when you turn out to be right.
In a 1992 Washington Monthly article, you wrote that the director of the CIA, William Casey, teamed up with a bunch of Madison Avenue advertising execs to sell the Contras to the American people. And one of the stated aims of the group was to, quote, glue black hats on the Sandinistas and white hats on the Contras. Was the campaign effective in the end?
The campaign was effective. The administration was able to push back against the Washington and National Press Corps. Many of the problems of the Contras were not examined very significantly. The stories about the Contra drug trafficking were pretty much rejected by much of the press corps. It took really another 13 years until the CIA put out a report that the Inspector General had done, which confirmed much of the information that we had reported back in the mid-1980s. It was just a case that there wasn't much career advantage for Washington journalists reporting tough, critical stories about the Contras or about the U.S. policies that are being carried out.
Are you getting a sense of deja vu?
Well, I think the second Bush administration also has been very aggressive in many of the same ways that the Reagan administration was, keeping a lot of things under wraps. For quite a while, the Congress has not done much in terms of oversight or investigative efforts. And the press corps, with the exception of, I think, what's happened the last several months, has been fairly tame. And so you have similar situations where there's a president who's been able to avoid much of the scrutiny that predecessors had. In the case of Reagan, the predecessors like Nixon or Ford, their administration's coming under a great deal of scrutiny, and of course, Clinton coming under a great deal of scrutiny in the 1990s.
Who would you say plays Mike Deaver in the current administration?
Who has the role of Deaver? Possibly Karl Rove, who has a very strong oversight of everything at the White House, especially their public image.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob Parry, formerly of the AP and Newsweek, is the editor of ConsortiumNews.com.
Coming up, shining a light on voter exclusion in the Sunshine State, and 10 years later, a hard time swallowing OJ.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Wednesday, a Florida judge heard CNN's case against Florida. CNN is suing for access to the state's list of convicted felons who may not vote without clemency from the state. In 2000, President Bush squeaked out victory in Florida with roughly 500 votes. That year, more than 170,000 felons in Florida had been purged from the voter rolls. Now it appears that perhaps thousands of eligible voters were purged along with them. Under state law, certain organizations, political parties, for example, may view and even copy the list of felons held by the state elections division if they swear not to reveal it. The press and public can view it too, but they can't copy it or take notes or tell anyone. CNN has been joined by Senator Bill Nelson, a Florida Democrat, in its efforts to make that list available. He joins me on the phone from Washington. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's a pleasure.
So, first of all, CNN is a big company. It can hire big-time lawyers to pursue this suit. Why did you feel the need to come to the aid of the network?
My aid is to the people of Florida when they go into that voting booth not to have happen what happened 4 years ago, where suddenly they're ready to cast their vote and are told, oh, you've been stricken from the voter rolls because you're a convicted felon, when in fact their name had been stricken because their name was similar to the name of a convicted felon. The issue here is the state of Florida has come up with a list of 48,000 felons that are to be stricken from the rolls.
For the 2004 election.
Exactly. The problem is that the state of Florida will not let the public nor the press examine the list
Now, the way I understand it, the public and the press are allowed to go in and look at it. They're just not allowed to copy it, and they're not allowed to take notes, which means you can check on it to see if your name's there, but you can't report on it because you can't take the information out.
And you have to swear on oath that you will not relay any of this information to another person. A totally decrepit kind of system. The question is, how are you going to be able to check and double check the names of 48,000 people that are going to be stricken from the rolls if you can't go in and transmit this information if you are a member of the public or of the press?
When was this law passed limiting access in this way?
In 2001.
Now, Senator, you're a politician. Maybe you can help me out with something here. After the 2000 election, we've since learned that the Florida felons list was riddled with inaccuracies that barred many eligible voters from the polls, and only a few hundred of them could have changed the outcome of the presidential election. So Florida decides to pass a law that makes it harder for the public and the press to check the accuracy of the list?
Clearly, I think a law like this is unconstitutional. As a matter of fact, we already know that some of the election supervisors in Florida's 67 counties have said that they have already found mistakes.
As a matter of fact, in Leon County, one of the inspectors found his or her own name on the list.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? The election supervisor spotted a name, and it was one of his own employees. And that employee clearly was not a convicted felon. So it shouldn't have been on there. And that's the whole point. There are going to be mistakes on a list of 48,000 people. So instead of striking their names from the rolls, why don't you let the public have access so they can check the list and recheck it?
Now, the state of Florida is saying that it's not allowing the list to be copied out of concerns for people's privacy. Do you think that this law will be stricken down as unconstitutional?
Well, if it isn't, I fear for the outcome, because every indication is that in this presidential election, Florida is split right down the middle. And if it comes down to a few votes deciding Florida, and if that decides the nation, here we go again. We can't afford to have any mistakes this time.
According to an investigative report by journalist Greg Pallast, most of the people that were wrongfully removed from the voter rolls back in 2000 were Democrats, and at least half were African American.
It doesn't make any difference if it's Democrat, Republican, Independent, whatever it is. We're all Americans, and we ought to have the right to vote. And that's what we're trying to preserve here.
Senator Nelson, thank you very much.
Okay, have a good day.
You too. Florida Senator Bill Nelson joined us by phone from Capitol Hill.
The sullied name of Clear Channel Communications is once again clear, at least as far as the FCC is concerned. In exchange for regulators scrapping all of the indecency charges against the radio behemoth, some of which stemmed from its broadcasts of the Howard Stern Show, all Clear Channel had to do was fork over $1.75 million. The deal represents the largest settlement ever between the FCC and broadcasters, and it could have ended much worse for Clear Channel. A bill pending in Congress right now would boost indecency fines from $27,000 to $500,000 per uncouth utterance. And that sum could theoretically have been multiplied by the number of Clear Channel stations that aired dirty words. But as Jacques Steinberg reported in the New York Times this week, the prospects for any indecency legislation making it to the president's desk this year are dim. He joins me now. Jacques, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, I know this is positively indecent, but what with the handover of sovereignty and Abu Ghraib and presidential funerals, until we read your story this week, we'd forgotten all about indecency. Where does the indecency question stand in the FCC and on Capitol Hill?
Well, as you say, there's sort of two tracks. I mean, firstly, in terms of Capitol Hill, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a relatively simple bill that would substantially raise the penalties. The Senate has been a little slower. A Senate Commerce Committee has approved a measure that would do lots of other things, including, you know, explore the issue of whether violence on television needs to be curbed. The Senate bill actually raises the question yet again of, you know, how big should we allow some of these companies to be and what should we permit them to own? The House bill doesn't want to touch that, in part because the president has said that he supports letting media companies get bigger. But as you say, events have sort of overtaken this, and I think there are some people on the Hill who don't think it seems quite as compelling now as it did, and maybe they've accomplished what they wanted to by sort of going on the record either approving a bill in the House or being supportive of it in the Senate.
Well, on the subject of flogging the decency question for what it's worth politically, in your piece in the New York Times on Monday, you quoted a man named Charles Cook, who is the editor of a political newsletter, saying, "Looks like a cheap date to me." Can you tell me what he was getting at?
I think Charlie was trying to make the point, and Charlie is very much down the middle on this sort of stuff, that it's the easiest thing in the world to say that you're for apple pie, you know, motherhood and keeping the nation's airwaves clean. It's quite another matter to actually stand up in the Senate or the House and vote for a bill and ensure that that bill gets to the president's desk.
Well, it must be very difficult to write a piece of legislation such as this, because if you are broad in defining what constitutes indecency, the law is too vague to enforce. And if you're too specific by listing, I don't know, a series of dirty words, you take the risk of being an object of ridicule, you know, a la George Carlin's seven words you can't say on TV.
And in fact, they've completely tabled the sort of arguably open question about what is it that you can't say, and instead taken what might be the easier question of, you know, how high should these fines be? You know, a lot of the broadcasters have said that where the most good could be done would be in the clarifying of these standards. But as you say, who would want to be the person who actually has to sift through that?
So let's go back to the FCC. The $1.7 million settlement, which was finally made official on Thursday, is a large number, but it certainly isn't anywhere near $500,000 per utterance. Do you know what kind of formula they put to agree on that figure?
I'm not sure of the formula, but it's indeed a compromise. In April, the FCC proposed fining Clear Channel $495,000 because a listener of a station in Florida that broadcast the Howard Stern program wrote in to complain about a couple of segments he had heard. But there are dozens of other complaints against Clear Channel stations that are at various stages in the pipeline. And Clear Channel agreed to pay $1.75 million to sort of clear the decks. And I'm sure that if all those other complaints were run down, it would be millions of dollars that Clear Channel would be on the hook for.
There was a lot of talk in the early part of the indecency discussion about the chilling effect of raising fines and of the saber rattling about challenging license renewals for stations that violate the decency rules. Do you believe that we're seeing that chilling effect in programming right now?
Well, you know, the New York Times and other papers have reported sort of anecdotally some funny things that are happening. I don't mean funny like laugh out loud, but I mean just sort of some strange things like radio stations taking off their playlist songs like The Bitch Is Back by Elton John or Bitch by the Rolling Stones. An Emmis communication station in Indianapolis used the dump button, that sort of electronic delay, to sort of bleep Rush Limbaugh one day on the words urinate, orgy, and damn, D-A-M-N.
And in fact, we are using the dump button to delete the words dump button. So this is just snowballing.
I think there certainly is some sense in Congress that maybe this is looking a little too puritanical and, is the pendulum swinging too far?
One final question. I don't know if you're a betting man or not, but, you know, if you were, would you say that a decency bill would be on the president's desk before the first Tuesday in November, or no?
I just don't think it's knowable at this time. I will say that it seems far less assured now that they will agree on something than it did, you know, sort of right after the Super Bowl when everybody was all excited, excuse the expression, about this.
All right, Jacques. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jacques Steinberg writes about media for The New York Times.
This weekend marks the anniversary of the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson, a crime that eventually led to a national obsession called the O.J. trial. The cable-televised proceedings ending in the acquittal of football legend O.J. Simpson mesmerized America for 9 months. The century's last trial of the century, and probably one deserving of the name. But upon further consideration, Slate's legal correspondent Dahlia Lithwick can't quite figure out why.
There's been this sort of OJ industrial complex that has tried to sort of affix all these meanings, you know, why this trial was a watershed. Many, many, many feminist legal thinkers say this was a sort of seminal moment in terms of thinking about domestic abuse. And there are a lot of professors who are interested in sort of law and race who say, no, this was a seminal moment in talking about race in America. And then there's people who think about juries and they say, no, this was a superb moment of jury nullification. That's the principle where juries come to sort of the right legal conclusion and then they ignore it for some larger reason. And so this has come to stand for that. It's come to stand for sort of 1,000 different things in the law. And yet my very strong feeling is that you could find other better cases to represent any of those.
In your piece, you note that Aaron Burr in 1807 complained that he couldn't get a fair trial because of all the publicity. And you note that Bruno Hauptmann, who was on trial for the kidnapping and murder of the Lindbergh baby in 1935, had more reporters covering him than covering all of World War I.
And the Scopes Monkey trial, which happened in the 1920s, the courtroom was so crowded with reporters that they had to move out to the courthouse lawn. I mean, one of the sort of pieces of mythology we've built up about O.J. is that this was the beginning of sort of public fascination with celebrity trials. I mean, that's simply not true.
You call this a blip, a one-time race to the bottom. How come?
Well, because I think that it was a sort of a perfect storm, if you will. There were all these factors. You know, cable television was just coming into its own. They were trying this experiment of what if we cover something gavel to gavel.
But as you say yourself, there were lots of other televised trials, too. Maybe television wasn't the deciding factor here either.
No, I think that's really important. You know, we forget that other trials, you know, the William Kennedy Smith trial was covered. The Adolf Eichmann trial was covered on television. Trials have been carried on national television since the 1960s. You know, it's hard to say what the factors are. It's hard to say why, you know, the William Kennedy Smith trial, which involved a Kennedy and it involved sex and all the things that should have really lit people up, just wasn't a media event. And I, you know, sit awake at night and think, why Scott Peterson? Why did this case capture the American imagination in a way that, you know, many of the other domestic murders don't? You know, guys kill their wives every day, and yet the American public seizes on some and not on others. And my strong suspicion, it has a lot to do with what the media conspires to tell them are going to be big, big sensational trials.
But I think what struck me most about your piece is that you didn't really blame the fact that it was a murder or sex or race or celebrity or even television for the OJ explosion. In the end, you seem to lay responsibility at the feet of the American television viewing audience.
Sure. I mean, the same people who, you know, are obsessed with American Idol and are obsessed with Fear Factor. I mean, we create the market for that. Just because there were televisions in that courtroom doesn't make it the media's fault. You know, there have been televisions in courtrooms, as I've said, before and since. We just didn't show up to watch.
In other words, the media can tell you that this is the trial of the century, but you don't have to listen. This time, we all did.
every 2 weeks they name a trial of the century. That's smart business sense. You know, it's no different from saying this is the best toothpaste in the world. But the market is usually smarter than that. The market knows that this toothpaste is no different from the last one. And I think we've become at least a little bit smarter so that when they told us that Martha Stewart was the trial of the century or the Unabomber trial or the Tim McVeigh trial or any number of trials that have happened subsequent to O.J., we've all went, ugh, not the trial of the century again. And yet, you know, I think with O.J., it was just a moment where we were all willing to say, ah, it's the trial of the century. I don't know that there's going to be another moment like that where the entire country is so riveted by the sort of arc of a trial, and particularly a trial like O.J.'s that went on for 9 months. I just don't know that that could happen again.
And so you call the O.J. Simpson obsession a sleazy one-night stand, and like all one-night stands, it has to come to an end.
One certainly hopes. I'm not encouraged when you hear that they're hiding cameras in the bushes outside of Michael Jackson's court proceedings. It makes me think we may just race to the bottom again, but so far, the American public, I think, has been pretty smart about not exactly joining into the sort of one-night sleazy sordidness that we engaged in last time around.
All right. Dahlia, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor for Slate.
Coming up, how to get famous and fired on the same day, courtesy of the Town Gossip.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The most reported news out of Washington in the past week was the funeral of Ronald Reagan. The little news, the really little and insignificant and snarky and unreliable and delicious and often hilarious news was on Wonkette.com, a gossipy weblog that has become the talk, the small talk anyway, of D.C. Wear a bad suit, write a foolish memo, lunch with the wrong lobbyist, and you may find yourself ruthlessly cut down to size. And if you are a Hill staffer documenting your giddy life of semi-prostitution, Wonkette can make you and break you at the same time. Anna Marie Cox is Wonkette, and she joins me now. Anna Marie, welcome to On the Media.
Good to be here.
We've called what you do gossip, but it's really more than that because there's a very large element of satire here. You make fun of people for a living, no?
Yes, finally. You know, it's something that got me in trouble pretty much all my life up until the month that I started doing Wonkette. And now I'm paid to lob spitballs from the back of the class.
You seem to have a low threshold of contempt. Are you really so unimpressed with your fellow residents of the world inside the Beltway, or are you just playing a role?
I've said that I have a very much a hate-love relationship with D.C. You know, the people here are boring, and the weather is bad, and architecture is terrible. But you know what? Like, D.C. is like the Alex P. Keaton of cities. Up front and on the surface, it's like incredibly boring and dry. But at home, like, they have a comic book collection and, you know, horror movie masks, and there's all this like weird, crazy stuff happening.
Just to clarify, is this the Michael J. Fox character on that?
On Family Ties.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to make sure.
It's hard to explain even. Like, the city does have this twisted side to it. Like, the way that people have really glommed onto Wonkette, and it really has taken off in a way that no one expected, it's that people almost wanted someone to hate them, you know?
Okay, which brings me to Jessica Cutler. Now, I think what put Wonkette on the map was its link to Jessica Cutler's weblog. Would you just please tell me about this episode and how you discovered her and then what happened next?
Someone just sent me a link to her blog, which was called Washingtonienne. It only had been a going concern for about a month, maybe 3 weeks. And it was a very brightly written diary of her sex life, her very graphic and somewhat risky sex life.
And occasionally remunerative.
Yes, occasionally. After all this happened, she was always very careful to say, like, it's not like people paid her for sex, but they were having sex and they were giving her money. Maybe it was just a coincidence. But and so I actually linked to it, and I had assumed that anyone that would keep a public blog like this would do something to disguise their identity. She really didn't. She had shortened the names of her lovers to initials, but beyond that, it was really, really, really easy for people to figure out who she was. I posted the URL of her website sometime before lunch. She came back from lunch, and she was fired.
She was a staffer for Senator Michael DeWine of Ohio, and he took a dim view of someone behaving that way and then writing about it. Did Wonkette destroy this young woman, or are you just giving her her first 15 minutes of fame, or just what kind of responsibility do you feel for this?
I definitely feel some responsibility. I got her fired, you know. I mean, it's a very basic equation there. However, she didn't seem too upset about it. She said that she didn't like her job anyway. She's going to have a, you know, spread in Playboy to show her kids, so not all of us have that.
God bless her. Now, but what about the issue of the gossip columnist's responsibility in general? You are mean for a living.
Mm-hmm.
How mean can you be over what is fundamentally, generally, trivial matters and still sleep soundly at night?
Well, I've said to people that I don't mind ruining someone's day. I just don't want to ruin their life. So that's a good measure. You know, there's some very obvious things, like I don't want to out anybody. I'm not interested in writing about affairs or marriages breaking up, mainly because those things aren't very funny. That's the sort of the thing about Washington, is because these people aren't incredibly famous, there isn't the same kind of ability to gossip about them with complete impunity that we feel about super famous people. And I'm kind of making this up as I go along, honestly. I think that blogging as a form of journalism or as a form of writing doesn't have a lot of rules yet. And it's clear that it doesn't need to try and hang, you know, the AP libel guide on a blog would be a mistake. To try and, like, apply your standard journalistic kind of ethical code seems too constrictive for what blogs are. There has to be something that you figure out maybe just on a day-to-day basis.
So if something's delicious but probably not true, do you run it?
That depends. Something came up actually this past week along those lines. I had been getting anonymous emails for weeks about Bill Bennett's dominatrix mistress. It would be nice if that were true, you know? It would be funny if that were true, but something about it, it would be almost more plausible if he had been taken up by aliens. So I didn't run any of these stories. However, there are bloggers who apparently thought it was interesting enough to run it. And I did take advantage of the fact that other people weren't as worried about lawsuits. And I linked to their coverage of this. But I did make it very clear when I linked to it that I thought this was a ridiculous story. And maybe that's kind of a sneaky way to get out of responsibility for running the story.
And I'm like, yeah. And when it gets passed on and attributed to Wonkette, maybe without some of the qualifications that you attached to it, won't you actually bear some of the responsibility for perpetuating, you know, what is in all probability a specious rumor?
Well, if someone takes
something... Allow me to answer. Yeah.
Okay. Well, if somebody takes something out of context out of what I've written, I can't control that. The other option would be just to never link to or write about anything that I wasn't 100%, you know, positive was true. And I don't think that that would be interesting or useful or necessary.
Anne-Marie? Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Anna Marie Cox is Wonkette. In the LA Times, Lloyd Grove said she's sarcastic, she's sharp, she's dismissive, she's funny, she's profane, and you know, there's a certain entertainment value to that. Grove would know all about the challenges inherent in mining the capital for entertainment. He was the gossip columnist for the Washington Post. But 8 months ago, he moved to a tougher town, and Brooke tracked his transition.
No, it's not the city of big shoulders, nor brotherly love, and it sure ain't the city of angels. It's where politics and media, real estate and Wall Street, Broadway and Soho, J-Lo and De Niro, Rudy, Rosie, Bubba, and a galaxy of distant worlds all collide into one dazzling 24-hour explosion of gossip. New York City, gossip capital, the gossip columnist's dream, you'd think.
I'm having trouble sleeping. There's tightness in my chest. From time to time, I think, I hope I'm not having a heart attack.
Lloyd Grove is the brand new gossip columnist for the New York Daily News, recently transplanted from the Washington Post. We first spoke to him just before he launched his column.
I feel like I'm actually scaling a vertical sheet of ice and hoping that I don't go falling off into the abyss.
No one at the bottom holding a trampoline?
Not in New York.
The thing is, New York has the most gossip, but it also has the most gossip columnists. The competition is fierce.
The premier gossip column is Page Six. It's in the New York Post, and it's headed by Richard Johnson, but it's written by a team of writers, and it is really the first place that people go.
MSNBC gossip columnist Jeanette Wells.
In addition to that, we also have in the New York Post Cindy Adams, who's sort of a dragon lady of gossip. And then we have Liz Smith, who's sort of the doyen, the good old gal of gossip. Then at the Daily News, we have Rushen and Malloy, a husband and wife team. They tend to specialize in celebrity stuff, but they often get mover and shaker type items as well. And now we have Lloyd's column as well. And then in the New York Times, they've also added a gossip column. It's called Boldface Names, which they don't like to call gossip because the New York Times pretends it doesn't do gossip. But that's how competitive the scene is right now.
Most New York gossip scribes work their way up, but Grove arrived full-grown from Washington, where he had gossip dominance. His move spurred a Page One feature in the New York Times, the AP, and even a little mention in the International Herald Tribune. When the city's dominant column, the Post's Page Six, ran an item on him, Grove called one of the writers seeking a correction and...
Then he said, we will send you back to Washington on a stretcher. Now, I'm told that the New York Times reporter called him to verify the quote, and he did verify that he'd said it. But he said, you know, if I'd been thinking more clearly, I would have said, send him back to Washington in a body bag.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by the reaction that Lloyd got.
George Rush is one half of the husband and wife gossip writing team, Rush and Malloy.
It just seemed like gangs of New York, where there were so many back alley boys who suddenly blew snuff into his face and started to pick his pocket. I think it bespeaks a nervousness on the part of his assassins that they do recognize that he's probably a better stylist as a writer than they are, and he may not go down as easily as some of the others have in the past.
Yes, others have failed, even at the Daily News. But Grove's column, called Lowdown, is up and running with items about a very short actor cruising a very tall model, a quote from Boy George that he's brighter than he looks, and a pungent airing of some famous dirty laundry.
There's little question that the best item that we had so far was Kerry Kennedy Cuomo going off on Uber publicist Dan Cloris, who's a close friend and advisor of her estranged husband, Andrew, at Michael's, which is the media watering hole in New York. And it was just sort of, what could be more human than an estranged wife going up to the friend of her husband, who she thinks has wronged her in a public place, and reading him the riot act? I mean, that's something that everybody can relate to. That's the sweet spot of a gossip column.
Ah, the sweet spot, enduring as a snowflake. As the founding father of newspaper gossip, Walter Winchell, once put it, nothing recedes like success. In fact, that's the seductive power of gossip.
It levels the playing field.
Neil Gabler is the author of Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity.
It takes the wealthy, the powerful, the famous, and by puncturing their veil of wealth, power, and fame, it brings them down to the level of the reader. There was a line by Leonard Lyons, the old gossip columnist, who said that gossip either takes them down or rises us up. Whatever the transaction is, I certainly think there's a very strong democratizing component to it.
And so it has endured from Winchell's mid-century heyday, with one crucial difference. Back then, the big shots were Winchell and Dorothy Kilgallen and Ed Sullivan, who started out as a gossip columnist. The celebrities were the supplicants, plying their wares through press agents who served as courtiers in the columnists' courts. Now the columnists are the courtiers, fed juicy tidbits by publicists at the convenience of the stars.
When people were willing to out themselves, when people were willing to control their own narrative and gossip columnists lost the power to control that narrative, that game was finished. It was a different game after that.
Recently, the Association of Theatrical Press Agents and Managers celebrated their 75th anniversary at a Broadway restaurant festooned with pictures of artists long faded or dead. Merle Dubusky is a senior member, and he remembers the days when Winchell reigned unchallenged at the Daily Mirror, a populist figure who struck fear in the hearts of the mighty.
When a number one most wanted criminal was turning himself in, didn't turn him into J. Edgar Hoover, turned himself into Walter Winchell. Well, can't you see Gotti or somebody turning himself into Cindy Adams today? It was a big difference.
When the power began to shift, the diminished Winchell was shunned for red-baiting and reduced to printing up his own columns and haunting his old watering holes. He was savaged in the 1957 movie The Sweet Smell of Success, the saga of a power-mad gossip columnist and his sleazy press agent flunky.
Burt Lancaster as J.J. Hunsaker, world-famed columnist whose gossip is gospel to 60 million readers. Tony Curtis as Sidney Falco, the kid who had ideas about taking over.
But we happen to know I'm your star pupil, because I reflect back to you your own talent.
I'd hate to take a bite of you. You're a cookie full of arsenic.
Merle Dubusky attended a special premiere for press agents in 57 and encountered the enraged model for Hunsaker outside.
And when we left, on the corner, with his foot up on the fire plug, was Walter Winchell, sneering at us. You dumb guys, don't you know when you're getting slandered? What are you crazy guys? Don't you have any pride? Stuff like that. He missed the point, I think.
The point is that everyone has their role to play, and no one is above nasty media portrayals, not least the practitioners themselves. The role of the gossip columnist is to tattletale on the fabulous without getting sued. To that end, they developed a particular vocabulary.
Canoodling is a useful word in that no one quite knows what it means, except that it does suggest some sort of romantic nuzzle.
George Rush.
It's a sort of libel-conscious word that, because it can't be precisely defined, it's not necessarily actionable. It's like a throwback to one of my favorite phrases from the Winchell era, where the code word would be that two people had become fast friends and dancing partners. And it's good when you can't quite establish what went on in the bathroom after someone closed the door.
Give us enough about the squalid doings behind that bathroom door, and we're bound to feel better about ourselves. Nobody can intimidate us anymore. Not celebrities, not even fellow gossip columnists with the long knives for the new guy. Lloyd Grove.
I mean, it might be offensive to some in New York to hear this, but I'm afraid you're not that special. You're just people. And I am not awed by you. You know, you're just fodder, grist to the mill, as far as I'm concerned.
Can you imagine the new guy in Chicago saying that to Chicagoans? Nah. In the words of that durable sage, Cindy Adams, only in New York, kids. Only in New York.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director. This week we say a fond farewell to engineer Rob Christensen, who's moving on to a job with benefits. Farewell, Rob. And we also say hello to our new engineer, Jennifer Munson. Hello, Jennifer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Mike Volo. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Pearl, Amy.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
All Millard Fillmore schools are now Ronald Reagan's. The Mississippi River is now the Mississippi Reagan.
And my good friend Frankenstein is now Franken Reagan. Blah!
Excellent.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.